This is Diane Sands recording Gail Gucci April 18th, 2001.
Is that working?
Okay, Gail.
Okay, Diane.
Okay, Gail.
How are you?
I'm ready for you guys to go home.
Saturday, maybe. Maybe Monday.
I wanted to talk to you for the Feminist History Project and start by saying, you know, these interviews are, of course, supplemental to a lot of other written material, but they're also, if you put yourself in the frame of mind of not being in the last couple days of the legislative session, but in many ways you're speaking to women and men 50 years in the future who might read this interview and want to know about your life, about your activism. So this section is really talking to people about their life as a feminist activist in Montana, and in particular, their activism in certain specific issues. So why don't you just start by talking about how you got here, who you are, what you do.
How I got to Montana or how I got to...
Yeah, Montana.
Okay, I came to Montana, to Missoula specifically, in 1992, and I came from St. Paul. And I specifically came to Montana for love. And it's true, and actually still am in that same relationship. So, but as soon as I got to Montana, first job I had was working at Planned Parenthood of Missoula, which is now part of Intermountain Planned Parenthood, but then it was Planned Parenthood of Missoula as the development director and also the public relations person. And so in terms of getting involved with the community and getting involved quickly, on a level, obviously, around reproductive rights and pro-choice issues, I quickly became involved in, I arrived in March, and then that fall, I got recruited to put together a pro-choice voter ID project, which we did that election cycle and then the next election cycle. And so I started out as an activist in Missoula. Not that it's the first activism I did, but just even landing, I felt like I was barely here when I was already really active in the community. And interestingly, I think Missoula is a community that welcomes that, that promotes that, that breeds that, and whatever your issues are. Lots of folks working on all sorts of kinds of issues in Missoula, and they're supportive of each other. And not only organizations are, but individuals are. And so that was my first kickoff, and I worked at Planned Parenthood for three or four years in that position, and did a little bit of lobbying at the legislature, not a lot, but that was when we first had the beginnings of the anti-choice legislature taking over. And a Republican legislature that was also anti-choice and a Republican governor just shortly after I got here. It was the end of Schwinden, I guess, because I don't even remember Schwinden. So, and we had, through my work at Planned Parenthood, I was involved with the Reproductive Rights Coalition, which actually began in 1991. So it had just begun.
Actually, it started long before that.
As officially the Reproductive Rights Coalition?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that's... Whatever.
But it was up and running.
It was up and running, and it's running stronger now. And I've been involved with it, well, since I've been here, obviously. But that's my beginnings in Missoula.
Why don't you talk about what happened? I mean, no one arrives, as you did, full-blown in Missoula as an activist, as you say. You learned that earlier. Where did you come to be an activist, and particularly a feminist activist?
Salt Lake City.
How?
I worked in Salt Lake. I moved to Salt Lake City in 1979, and I worked for a feminist publishing company called Network, and it later became Webster Publishing. Network was the particular magazine, a monthly magazine for and about working and professional women. And I started there selling advertising and quickly started writing articles and eventually doing editorial work. And it was owned and published by Karen Shepherd, who later became a congresswoman, but not at that point. But she was very political, obviously, and all of us were very political in our own right. And we worked hard to get Frances Farley actually elected. She missed by literally they were like write-in votes. They were the ballots that came at the very end. But anyway, so in the things that we wrote about and covered in Network, and it certainly wasn't everything I wrote, but were the hot issues of the time. It was abortion and domestic violence, and child care issues were huge because most employers didn't have it, and particularly in Salt Lake. So, and we did a Roe v. Wade march, maybe 81 or two, and around the Mormon temple, only 100 of us. And it was during Mormon conference, there was tens of thousands of people there. It was a little scary because there were so few of us and there were so many of us, and we had signs and we did it. But there was maybe 100 of us, but fully 10 of us were from Network, you know, 90 other people from Salt Lake. So, and it was interesting to work at a feminist publishing company in Salt Lake because it really was a little oasis in the desert. And people often ask me about that. How did you ever survive in Salt Lake? Well, that's how I survived and thrived. And not only did I love that work, but they were very supportive of me politically and activist-wise and every other way. Excuse me. So,
good training for being in the legislature.
It was good training for being in the legislature. It was good training for doing any political work or issue work. We did work, like I said, on a couple campaigns. Frances Farley is the one that really sticks out. We really worked hard to get her elected to Congress and didn't. But we also published twice, called the Women's Index, and it was a listing of women's services and businesses. And although there were some of those being published in the United States, because it was Salt Lake, I guess, we got on the Today Show. And so we got national coverage on it. And what we did also, besides publish it, was obviously encourage women to utilize the services and the goods and the products and the businesses of women. And all of that, I think, is part of how you get folks networking together and working to support each other. And we did publish the index twice in the early 80s, I would guess 82 and 83 or something. And also Gloria Steinem came out to speak, and so I got to meet Gloria Steinem, and obviously she was speaking everywhere, but she came in conjunction with the index and spoke. We actually got a chance to meet her and talk with her personally, and she was definitely my hero then.
What impact did that have on you? What did it mean to you?
I found her to be, besides an incredibly strong, intelligent, thoughtful, well-reasoned, humorous woman, she was also very personable. You probably met her your own self several times, but she was personable and friendly and acutely interested in Network as an organization, but also individually what we were doing there, and spoke with us at some length personally. We had a small party with maybe just 10 of us with her. And we actually got a chance to, you know, listen to her. You know, politically, she was probably quite a bit further to left than I was at that point, that I was moving that way rather rapidly. But so, I mean, I think she had a pretty big influence on me. I think it occurred to me that it was possible for women to be like Gloria and be successful and really make a difference in the world. And so, I mean, I always remember it, obviously. I happened to be really ill when I met her, so I didn't have the same connection I might have today. But anyway, that was my beginnings of, I would say, actually, prior to then, back in high school and even in college a little, because that was during the first Earth Day was when I was in high school.
When did you graduate from high school?
72, I think about that. But the first Earth Day was 70. So I was a sophomore, and we definitely did a bunch of activities around that, including planting trees, and I don't know, we did a bunch of recycling and cleanup and stuff. But I had never thought about any of that before. So it was a little bit of a start there. And in the college, when I was in college, was the Vietnam War and the end of the Vietnam War. So we were active a bit around that. So I guess guess I wouldn't say my very first was in Salt Lake, but that was when I started working with a feminist publishing company. I mean, I never worked in a feminist organization prior to then. And then it was just like total immersion as opposed to occasional forays into whatever, Earth Day or whatever. So, and I grew up in a Republican conservative family, and they still all are. And so it was definitely a move for me to follow my own beliefs, especially my own political beliefs, but also on issues, which for me a lot have been environmental and reproductive rights have been sort of the two areas where I've spent a lot of my time and energy.
So how did you grow to become a feminist from a Republican family? How did you first come to think of yourself as a feminist? What did that mean, and how have you evolved your understanding of yourself as a feminist?
I think I probably first was aware of being a feminist definitely before I met Gloria Steinem, but back in high school when we were definitely hearing her talk. And I used to argue with my dad every night at the dinner table over that. And the more he argued to the right of me, the further I moved to the left. And we specifically used to argue about Gloria Steinem and what she was talking about, and Angela Davis. And the church I went to, which was a Presbyterian church in White Bear Lake, Minnesota, elected to support Angela Davis, I think it was financially. And my dad came unglued. And I thought it was a great idea.
When she was on trial for murder as
yep.
part of the Black Panther.
Yep.
So I raised money for that.
Yep. Mm-hmm. But I was a teenager. So yeah. I was, you know, young. And I thought it was a great idea.
The first time anyone threatened to kill me personally.
That didn't happen. So I was sort of solidifying. I don't think I would have said, oh, I'm a feminist. But I was clearly identifying mm-hmm. with the strong women feminist leaders and actually being able to make arguments on their behalf, on the behalf of their issues and their...
Why? What does it have to do with you, Gail?
I think it had everything to do with me. I mean, as a person growing up with two brothers and no sisters, I always, in some ways it was a good thing because my dad really did treat us all the same and allowed us and encouraged us all to do the same kinds of things. So I actually grew up doing a ton of sports, just like the boys, and I grew up also knowing I would go to college. That was equal for all of us. But there was other inequality stuff that I didn't like, especially just around household chore kind of stuff, which I really felt, I felt uncomfortable with it, and I was pretty angry about it. Even as a kid, it's like, that isn't fair. Why should I do all this stuff and they don't have to do any of that stuff? So I think as I grew politically and started really listening to sort of the current events of my teenage years, which would have been in the late 60s and the early 70s, that I got pretty cemented into thinking that to be all that I could be, I needed to be a feminist, and I was never afraid to say it or afraid to stand up for those issues and marched in countless, especially pro-choice rallies, but several political stuff as well. So I don't know. I can actually sort of pinpoint when I think I became pro-choice. It's more difficult for me to pinpoint, sort of crossed this line here and became a feminist. But I think I know in my teenage years I was definitely moving towards it and embracing it. Certainly never felt like it was forced on me. It's like, oh, I'm very comfortable mm-hmm. with that. But I know when I was a teenager, when I was 15, I started dating this guy who was 1 year older, but he was one of eight children, and his parents were married when they were teenagers, and his mother was 17, and I think his dad was 18. By the time she was 20, she had four children. By the time she was about 26, she had all eight. And when I knew Mike, he was telling me about the fact that, you know, his mom didn't want to have all those kids. And I said, well, why did... It was really a mystery to me, because my mom and dad obviously used birth control, and he said, well, you know, we're Catholic, can't use birth control. And I said, oh. And then he told me this story about his youngest sister, who was about eight at the time, and the circumstances of her birth, which was that when his mother became pregnant with her, she went to her priest and said, I cannot have another child. I cannot. And abortion was not legal. And he said, well, that's obviously not an option for you, you know what I mean? So she had the child. But when he told me that, coupled with, oh, and she's not allowed to use birth control, all the bells went off, and I said, that is the most unjust, unfair thing I've ever heard of. She has no control over her reproductive health, and she is not allowed to have an abortion. And of course, when I was in high school, well, actually, a year after is when Roe v. Wade was enacted, so I just thought, I was outraged. That was most outraged. Not at him, just at the whole circumstances of that inequality, mm-hmm. and that how unjust that was for a woman to have all those children when she truly didn't want to, but did, obviously.
So how did that become activism on that? What's your first involvement in something that's more organized?
I think, I'm trying to remember the first time I marched in a pro-choice rally. I don't believe there was any in high school, or that I knew of. So it would have been during college. But also during college, in fact, in high school, I think lots of women could repeat this story, but my best friend and my roommate got pregnant, and so I was the one who went with her. And by then, abortion was legal. And so I went with her up to the clinic and sort of the accompanying person. And I saw how those clinics worked and the kind of counseling that happened and what good care she got and the treatment, really respectful and all of that. And although I wouldn't call that an activist, it was an active involvement. It wasn't activist on behalf of a lot of folks. Mm-hmm. But it definitely cemented what I already knew from back in high school, that this was a right that women had to have, and that we had to protect, and that we had to allow for all women, regardless of, in particular, their income, which mm-hmm. is the big, the big problem, because women who can't afford abortions still mm-hmm. can't get a legal abortion. But
hold on a second.
Yeah.
A very specific. Sort of click moments in the Steinem thing, and others have a series of things.
My click moment with that was definitely when Mike told me about his mother.
Mm-hmm.
But then I did some volunteer work in St. Paul for the Planned Parenthood there. Did some phone surveying, and definitely we marched in a couple Roe v. Wade rallies. And in the Twin Cities, they were huge. They were not like Salt Lake. They were huge. Thousands, 5,000, 6,000 women and men marched. So I definitely did participate in those ways. And then really became more involved when I moved to Salt Lake, and then involved again in a different way, mm-hmm. on a more specific, direct level when I moved to Missoula. Because my job in Salt Lake, although we certainly dealt with reproductive rights and abortion, was one piece of the bigger feminist pie that we were dealing with. And when I moved to Missoula, then I was specifically working on reproductive rights.
Was that something you were particularly interested in, or was it the opportunity that there was a position available, Planned Parenthood, and there's so few positions available?
It was both, but I was really interested in it, and I had been growingly interested in it really since I was a teenager, and becoming more and more convinced that this right we're going to have to work to protect, as we are still working to protect it for a long time, and that it was going to take a lot of us to stand up for that right. And so certainly it was a job opportunity, there's no question, but as you well know, it's not like working at a nonprofit is a great career opportunity in terms of making good money or benefits or any of that stuff. So you do that for the love of the work, or you don't do it. And I really did like it. I hadn't ever done development work before, but I had been a writer and editor, and so all those skills just transferred directly to grant writing and fundraising letters, and it wasn't even new skill learning. It was just moving them to a different compartment.
Why don't you tell us about Missoula Planned Parenthood then, and what it generally did, and how you fit into that?
Missoula Planned Parenthood, when I first started there, did not do abortions. And but it wasn't very long after I got there that we started doing abortions because Blue Mountain Clinic was, there was the arson at Blue Mountain Clinic. I don't even know the year, Diane, I'm sure you do.
Mm-hmm. 93. Don't worry about it. Yeah.
93. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense because mm-hmm. it was within the year I started mm-hmm. at Planned Parenthood. And we were, I wouldn't say we were forced, but we were certainly, our board got right on top of it and said, there's no provider now in Missoula. No clinic provider. Obviously, right. There were some individuals. So Planned Parenthood board got right on top of it, and within a month, we had the abortion clinic up and running once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still running. And Blue Mountain is, of course, up and running and also does abortions, I also believe, weekly. So, but it was interesting to watch, and I was a staff, but it was interesting to watch the board gel over it really quickly and move really fast to fill a gap. And there was a gap. And it was a good year and a half before Blue Mountain was up and running again. It was a long time, longer, I think, than most of us thought it was going to be. So we certainly didn't perceive it as competition because they weren't running. And like every other clinic, it's not a very big percent of the mm-hmm. overall business that's at Planned Parenthood. And I certainly didn't have anything to do with any of the medical stuff. All I did was fundraise, run events like the auction, write fundraising letters, and do a bit of I did do the legislative piece in terms of the Reproductive Rights Coalition and the little bit of lobbying and testifying we did, which wasn't a lot. And so that was my piece. I worked half-time. I guess it was 22 hours a week, just over half-time. But Planned Parenthood now, for the first time since I have lived in Montana, actually had a lobbyist at the legislature. And that was really important because there was three lobbyists. There was Planned Parenthood, this session, Planned Parenthood and Montana NARAL, which is always lobbied, and then ACLU actually, and she did lobby other things, mm-hmm. but they gave her a big chunk of time to work on reproductive rights. And considering that we had 10 or 11 bill drafts and six actual bills that were introduced that were anti-choice this session, and those three women, they defeated all of them in mm-hmm. a very anti-choice legislature. So it was really an accomplishment, and I thought it was a real incredible accomplishment. They did it in a lot of ways. They targeted those few swing legislators who they could. They, especially in the Senate, not so much in the House, in the more august Senate, were able to get leadership, even Republican leadership, to see the light on these really evil and unworkable bills. And they maneuvered really well procedurally and got the members, like Steve Doherty, Senator Doherty, and Senator Halligan, to make the right moves at the right time to kill these bills, certainly more successfully in the Senate than in the House. But there's fewer members and a little more experience there. So, Planned Parenthood has changed. They're now under the guise of Intermountain Planned Parenthood. At the time, they were, I believe, the only Planned Parenthood clinic in Montana that wasn't part of Intermountain.
Correct.
Back when
right.
I worked there.
Mm-hmm.
And what, about 3 years ago?
Right, so now it's Billings, Helena, Great Falls, and Missoula.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
All under that. And so I'm pleased to see them spend some time and effort and money on lobbying over here, because as long as we continue to have a anti-choice legislature, both in the House and the Senate, and a governor who's anti-choice, and we just went from one anti-choice governor to, unfortunately, our first woman governor who's also anti-choice, we need more than one person, even though it's mm-hmm. only a 90-day session. It's too much for one person to do. It's just not possible. And Montana Women's Lobby has been really strong in this, obviously, and did help out with the efforts this time. But again, Montana Women's Lobby has a lot of other issues they have to cover besides mm-hmm. reproductive rights. That's one of mm-hmm. A whole platter. Whereas those, well, especially J.J. Straight from Planned Parenthood and Stacey Anderson from Montana NARAL, all they did was reproductive mm-hmm. rights. And Beth Brenneman from ACLU did 80% reproductive rights, and it made a huge difference. And I think the legislators will tell you that, both in the House and the mm-hmm. Senate.
Well, it's an interesting combination of three lobbyists, one of whom is an attorney and deals with it mm-hmm. from that angle, one of whom is a provider and deals with it from that angle, and the other that's an activist. So you have three, the convergence of the three different components of it as well.
Yep, and three really different personalities. And I will say, gleefully, youthful, all of them, 30-ish, all of them, instead of 40-ish, 50-ish, mm-hmm. which is great, because we really need them. We need that younger set, and not that 30 is so young, but 30 and younger, we need working on this issue.
You've been such an activist for a long time in the legislature also in trying to pass legislation that provides for insurance coverage of contraception. Where is that at? Kind of what's been going on with that? We defeat all the bad bills. What are we doing to move anything that's positive?
Okay. Did we have two or three? We did introduce the contraceptive coverage bill again this session, and it was introduced last session. To the best of my knowledge, that's only two times it's been introduced in Montana. Last session, it was carried by Marianne Guggenheim, who sadly was defeated this time by Dave Lewis. But this time, Christine Kaufman from Helena carried it. And actually, last time we did a little better. We got it out of committee last time. This time, it died in committee when two or maybe three of the Republicans co-signers voted against it in committee. But that's the kind of pressure they got from their caucus. And it's not surprising, given that our Speaker, Dan McGee, has as his higher mission the call to end abortion, and has said so publicly on the House floor, in the newspapers. And before the beginning of the session, he talked about it, said it was a higher calling, literally, for him. So that's the kind of pressure the few pro-choice folks they have on that side, and there are some, get pressured to vote even against something like contraceptive coverage. So it did not get out of committee. We did have a great blast attempt. Christine attempted to blast it on the House floor, and I spoke, obviously, in favor of that blast, as did a couple other people. We got, I don't know, 45, 46 votes. But we couldn't get it out of committee. We obviously didn't pass it this time. And will we pass it in the future? Some point we'll pass it in the future, but not with our numbers as far apart as they are in the House and the Senate. We can't get it passed. But the other bill we had was carried by Tom Facey, proactive bill, this session. And it was, well, we pared it down. First it was a comprehensive, factual-based sex education. And then we decided that had no chance of going anywhere. So what we pared it down to was that school districts had to report back to the OPI about what they were doing. Just tell us what your curriculum is, tell us where you get it, and then we'll look at it to see if it's factual-based. Again, this didn't get out of committee. They weren't going to let any of this stuff out of committee. But, you know, what happens, I think, that can work is it's a good educational piece. We got, in particular, the contraceptive coverage bill got a lot of good press, and it shows their true colors on they're being anti-choice folks. Okay, you're opposed to abortion, but you're also opposed to contraceptive coverage as a matter of course for anybody who gets insurance and gets the rest of their medications covered. How does that make any sense? So that exposes them. We didn't get as much exposure on the sex ed bill, but we did get, I thought, really good coverage on the contraceptive coverage bill. So those were the two. And there was another strategy to that. Those were the two proactive, and we really thought long and hard about doing it. And we nearly did a third one, which actually came out of the Law, Justice, and Indian Affairs Interim Committee, which I sit on. But I wasn't at this committee meeting when this happened. But the Physician's Assistant Bill came out of there, as well as another attempt at banning so-called partial birth abortion. And the Physician's Assistant Bill that came out of the committee would have simply said the legislature agrees with the Supreme Court finding that physician's assistants can in fact perform abortions in Montana. It's a great finding. It's a great court victory for us. However, upon
following the loss in the previous legislative session where that was.
And that was 95 or 7? Were you
five.
Here? 5. Yes, so what happened was there was a bill passed in 95 that banned physician's assistants from performing abortions in Montana.
Which really applied to only one woman, Susan Cahill and Kalispell.
When in fact there was only one, Susan Cahill and Kalispell. So what this bill came out, and it was a committee bill, so it came out from, as Ben Wood said, the top, Law, Justice, and Indian Affairs Interim Committee. And that was a great idea, but upon further reflection and a lot of soul searching, both on my part personally, because they have put my name on this bill to carry it, but also with National NARAL and Planned Parenthood and ACLU, we decided it was a very dangerous thing to do. We did not have the votes to hold it or pass it, and they could have changed it in any way, shape, or form they wanted. In fact, not nullified the court decision, but made the court decision look very weak. And in the end, I said, I don't want to do this. And I just never picked it up. I just let it languish. But meantime, running parallel on that track, Dan had put in the second, I didn't, but also out of that committee, was the so-called partial birth abortion. This would have been the third attempt to ban it by this legislature. It had already been passed twice, in 97 and 99, to ban so-called partial birth abortion. Both times held up and overturned in court. This would have been a third attempt, and the way they were trying to get around it this session was to define viability. Okay. Well, that also came out of the Law, Justice, and the Affairs. So these two bills were LCs running their course parallel, and I was literally on the phone daily, both to Stacey Anderson at NARAL, but also to Legislative Service, going, anybody pick up that bill yet? Is it still an LC? Mm-hmm. And I said, I want to be talking to you at 5 o'clock on the last day, because if they're going to pick up this bill, I may have decided to pick up the physician's assistants just to give them. So that was... And again, that was a real strategy play. And I'm sure they were watching just as closely to see if I was going to pick it up. I understand that. But nobody ever picked it up. And in fact, nobody was assigned that bill when it came out of committee, because it was Speaker Dan McGee's bill. And as much as he is a maverick on this issue, I don't know if it was because he was a speaker or whether because Tom Beck in the Senate said, you need to stay away from this, or some combination thereof, but he never put his name on it, and he couldn't obviously find anyone else to put their name on it. So it just never happened. There was a second bill in, and he never picked it up, I never picked up physician's assistants. Those bills just died. They just went away, because they never became bills. There was a second so-called partial birth abortion in, I think Dwayne Grimes put it in. He never did anything with it either. I don't know where that went. So we didn't have to deal with that issue this time. But this is a long way of coming back to what I was talking about earlier, the proactive bills that we did introduce. Part of the reason we did that, so we could have a good message out there, and those messages weren't about abortion, comprehensive sexuality education and contraceptive coverage, it's not about abortion. So those were good messages for us to have as a reproductive rights coalition, but also we wanted to keep them just as busy as they're keeping us. And we get tired of all the time having to line up the testimony. And they had to do the same thing. Even though they knew those bills had a really small chance, they lined up all the testimony against them. They had to spend all the time, and just like we did, probably did some strategy meetings like we did. And we just thought that was a smart thing to do strategically and not just be backed into the corner of having to battle against these six really negative anti-choice bills.
You've talked about it some, but... for the future, why don't you talk some about the Reproductive Rights Coalition, particularly, I think a good example might be getting ready for the session. Who's involved? How are decisions made relative to, particularly since this focus has been primarily trying to come to some consensus around legislative action? How does that happen, and who plays in that, and what's your role in that?
I have participated in that coalition, like I said earlier, I guess for the nine years that I've been in Montana. But there's lots of groups who are involved, and some are involved really actively in a lot, and those are Montana NARAL, Blue Mountain Clinic, Planned Parenthood, ACLU. Those four groups, I would say, are definitely the cornerstone groups, but they're not the only groups. University Women on occasion have been in, BPW on occasion come around, Montana Nurses Association. So there are other groups, depending on the legislation and the timing. And the coalition primarily meets during the legislative session. On occasion, we do meet in the off year, mainly just to check in maybe and say, what's up? But we start meeting in earnest, 4 or 5 months before the legislature, and then during the legislature, weekly. And anybody, actually, Human Rights Network was really active this time as well, and so was Department of Health and Human Services. And so those are some other players.
Women's lobby at all?
Sorry, women's lobby. Yeah, just don't have the list
That's
in front
good.
Of me. Yep. And so those folks got together, and immediately, way back when I was talking about tracking those other two bills that came out of Law, Justice, and Indian Affairs, they're already tracking every LC out there, good, bad, and ugly. And like I said, there were 11, I believe, and six got introduced, about half got introduced. And they're tracking them, and they're also sort of targeting and tiering them. Okay, if this comes up, what's going to be our first priority, second, third, fourth? Hopefully we won't have too many more after that, although they had to go all the way to six this time. And so that's what they did as a group. And I did participate as a legislator, but frankly, more when the legislature was on, because they would hold the meetings like right across the street, and I could just go over there at lunch and participate. And in particular, around the fetal rights bill that was introduced this time by Bob Davies, and Christine Kaufman's contraceptive coverage, we did a lot of strategizing around, well, on Christine's how to pass it, obviously, and on Davies how to kill it. But there were other ones that we dealt with, the pharmacist clause, which came up late. And what that is... it allows an exemption for pharmacists to say, well, I don't want to give you birth control of methods of whatever sort that they sell through the pharmacy, which would be mostly the pill, but not only. So yeah, we didn't think it was a good idea. We actually killed that one in committee. So, but anyway, that's what they do as a coalition. They meet, they strategize, they agree. You know, because you've participated longer in this coalition than I have, but there have been sessions where we had trouble agreeing on what the legislation was going to be that we would either offer or work against. But not this time. It was pretty amazing.
It's usually much easier to agree on what you are going to oppose than
exactly.
what you're going to support.
Exactly.
And your capacity, you're there now in the capacity of being a pro-choice legislator, but in the past you've served on that in your role as the president or chair of NARAL or Montana's for Choice.
Right. I'm the board chair for Montana NARAL, and that's why I have, and I've been in that position 3 years. And prior to that, on the board for probably 3 years. So I've been on the board in some capacity for, I think 6 years is accurate. And actually, I just, in a week from now, I'll be going to Washington, D.C. to participate in my first national NARAL board meeting. So I have been involved on that level
Are you going on the national board?
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
My first board meeting was the 27th, whatever a week from Saturday is. So, yeah, and that'll be interesting. But and I will continue to serve in my capacity as a NARAL representative on the coalition. But frankly, our director, Stacey Anderson, is at every meeting. Mm-hmm. And I go to as many as I can, and I don't make it to every meeting. So
you've been on the board for that organization through two or three directors.
Eliza
yeah, Fraser there?
Eliza, Christine. I guess we're on the fourth. The NARAL has certainly undergone a lot of change in the last several years, and we've had Stacy now for two. She's just beginning her third year. And she's actually doing a great job. She's really committed, and she's...
And I'm probably going to talk to her as well, but from the position of being a board person, what would you say, I mean, why are you an activist within NARAL when there are lots of other organizational choices, and what do you see as the mission of NARAL?
Well, the mission of NARAL, as opposed to service providers like Blue Mountain and Planned Parenthood, who actually, you know, make sure women get the reproductive right or reproductive health care they need to get, NARAL, on the other hand, both statewide and nationally, is the political branch of pro-choice. So they do the legislative work and the lobbying and all the C4 and PAC work that, frankly, Planned Parenthood in this state does not even have a PAC. Did do some C4 work this time, but for years has really only done C3 work. So that's the mission of NARAL. You know, I have been involved with Planned Parenthood, so I certainly, and I sat on the Reproductive Rights Coalition as the Planned Parenthood rep when I was in that position. So I've kind of continued in the Reproductive Rights Coalition through moving through different organizations. And I've been not as seriously involved with Blue Mountain, but some. I've helped out with their race and stuff. So I don't know. I mean, they're all working on women's reproductive health and making sure that it is safeguarded. And I'm not sure that I actually so much chose a particular one. I did Planned Parenthood for several years. Now I'm doing NARAL. I'm a client of Blue Mountain and help them out voluntarily on a more limited basis. But personally, though, the political work is more interesting to me. So rather than the provider work, so it makes some sense to me that I'm with NARAL on a longer term and more involved, including now moving up to the national board. Because I'm a legislator, but I was involved with this long before I was a legislator. I like the political, I liked working from the political realm, and I like being able to maneuver within that realm, but also to try to influence policymaking. And so, to me, staying with reproductive rights work that I can be politically involved with, that's where I would see myself going in the future, as well as my most immediate past.
We've talked about your interest in the political arena. Well, you also were very instrumental a couple of different times in the election aspect of this, not just the legislative aspect. Why don't you talk some about the Women's Vote projects and what was trying to be accomplished and all of your involvement in that?
Prior to doing the Women's Vote, coordinating the Women's Vote project, I coordinated, and we touched on this briefly, two pro-choice voter identification projects out of Missoula, where we literally called registered voters. We hoped they were registered anyway, and they're supposed to be, and surveyed them to find out where they were on the pro-choice, if they were sort of pro-choice or mostly pro-choice or not at all pro-choice. And then we utilized that information to try to elect pro-choice legislators and Congress. We worked on Pat Williams' campaign, Max Baucus, and some who weren't successful, Jack Mudd. We might have done some for, no, but anyway. So we worked to identify those women and men who were pro-choice and then to mobilize them to vote for those folks. And then in 90...
Who was the we?
Oh, those projects were in Missoula, and so there were certainly lots of groups involved, actually. WORD, Women's Opportunity Resource Development, certainly gave us volunteers. YWCA gave us some volunteers. Missoula Pro-Choice gave us a lot of volunteers, and what I did was coordinate all those volunteers and make sure that they understood and could accurately deliver the survey and record the data, and then we process the data, et cetera. And we were happy to share it with the candidates as well. And, you know, one big success we had was getting Jeff Weldon elected. He fully credited us with getting him elected
to the state senate,
in Montana. So that was the we. It was local to Missoula. It was Missoula volunteers. We worked in conjunction with the Democrat Party insofar as we shared resources, their phones, their space, which they were already doing phone banks, but volunteers were separate, and the whole survey was separate, and they needed to be, actually. Both times that we did that, we coordinated with the Democrat Party, Montana Democrat Party, but in Missoula. There were other pro-choice voter ID projects going on throughout the state, but I was not involved with them in other cities. And then in, was it 95, we did the Montana Women's Vote Project? Which actually something you cooked up pretty much, Diane, but it was after we saw the tremendous drop-off of Montana women voting. And so what election was that? Was it Clinton?
In reaction to the, yeah, that was the 96 election.
Yeah. So, and they just dropped off in droves. Montana women, we studied what was available for, I guess, exit poll information, et cetera, and we saw that Montana women didn't vote. They voted in really low numbers compared to what we believed they had voted in the past. So, again, there was a lot of groups, and this was statewide groups who came together. Particularly strong factions, I thought, out of Great Falls, the BPW folks up there, Missoula.
And the AAUW out of
it. And the AAUW, maybe that was it. Sorry, AAUW.
Shirley.
Yeah, okay, AAUW. And Billings put together, Christine Phillips, who had been the director at NARAL briefly, had moved to Billings, and she was really good. And Joan Hurdle, who's a legislator in her last term here, were instrumental in the Billings piece. And then there was a pretty active group, Helen in Bozeman.
Kerr.
And she worked with another woman. So that was statewide. And then Missoula, of course. In Missoula, it was easy to sort of tap those same volunteers and those same groups who had been active on the pro-choice voter ID projects. But the other cities, we needed to do a little different coordinating in. And we did meet statewide several times. It was a little difficult because it was once I took my car off the freeway doing 70 miles an hour on my way there because it was winter for a large piece of it. But we had a pretty ambitious goal of surveying 20,000 Montana women to find out what issues motivated them. We asked choices around, or questions around where they stood on pro-choice, reproductive rights, domestic violence, education, childcare, environment. And we had a long survey. It's long.
And I believe we'd had some assistance from Celinda Lake.
We had Celinda Lake.
Pollster, who's originally from Montana, and trying to craft that and make it consistent with other polling questions so there'd be some continuity.
What we wanted to find out, though, was what issues motivated these women and why they didn't vote. And then we asked the demographic questions as well, of course, income and age and number of children and those kinds of things. And party identify, how they self-ID'd. And the survey was really long, and we had, the only paid help that I know of was me. I was paid to be the statewide coordinator. I believe everyone else worked volunteer. At some point, we actually hired Linda Stahl, I think, to work part-time on it. She actually got paid maybe 10 hours a week or something. But
the big issue was in the capacity of being the last Matt Monsell director.
Right.
Yes.
Right. That's right. She was Monsell director
right.
at the time. Good. That's right. Anyway, the survey was long, and we immediately, within a couple of weeks, realized it was taking too long. It would take 15 minutes at least for somebody to administer, which does not bode well for getting a lot of numbers done. So it took us some time working with Celinda. It seems like it was a pretty long time, 3 to 4 weeks, to get the survey shorter, and then we used those computerized punch cards so that we could feed the data in through the computer. And actually, the data entry and coordination was all based out of Missoula, and it was Pam Dietrich, who volunteered her time, which was hours and hundreds of hours of work, working with those cards. And they had the same problem with the hanging chads and the stuff as we had in our last election. But she did get it all input, and we actually still do have that data. The upshot was we ended up interviewing and surveying and collecting data for, I think, just under 6,000 women. So we were short of our goal. Still, it was a pretty interesting sampling across the across Montana. And we did collect some very useful data. We found out the top two reasons that women didn't vote were they didn't have enough time, and they didn't know either the candidate or what the candidate stood for, and they were unwilling to vote for him or her if they didn't know where they stood on the issues. And that was really interesting to those of us who worked in the sort of steering committee of it all, and frustrating too, because in my opinion, men don't care if they don't know the issues of another candidate. They're going to vote. They're going to get out there and vote, and they're going to do the best they can with the knowledge they have. So it was frustrating to know, although it was enlightening, to know that women, if they didn't have this information, were not going to vote. And then we looked at candidates' brochures, and sure as heck, they don't say on there what they stand for or the issues that they're going to be championing or voting against or whatever. And so then we, of course, encouraged women to ask those questions, ask the candidates where they stand on these issues. It's interesting you bring that up because Joan Hurdle and I were talking about this last night, that we need another project like that in Montana right now. Maybe it's not the Montana Women's Vote Project, but something where we get Montana women and to gel and to get motivated politically, either to run for office or to help people get elected to office or to at least vote for the right people in office. And we do need that, and we need it soon. We could start right after this legislative session. And the things that have changed in my mind about that is it's not enough to just know that women care about protecting their right to choose. And in fact, that always comes off pretty low on the list than it did this time too, although it is a baseline issue for folks who aren't going to, often won't go over that line. But it's not enough to know they care about funding for education, or they'd prefer a cleaner environment, or we have to know, will they vote for those people who are going to do that? Can we count on them to do something for those people who will champion it? Because that, to me, was the flaw, both in the survey and in the data we got. And we did the best we could. It was 6 years ago. That if I were to redesign it today or help redesign it, I would want to ask those questions in a way that would find out not just the issues they care about, but what motivates them to do something, preferably vote or get somebody elected to office who stands for those issues. And I still think we have, I don't have any hard data on this, but I don't think we have women voting in huge droves. We don't have women running for office in huge droves.
So what difference does that make to you, do you think? Why does it matter if women vote? Why does it matter if women get elected?
Well, because if women vote, we vote in candidates who are inevitably better on our issues, or maybe I should just say my issues, the issues that I care about, the ones we just named, reproductive rights and environment and funding for education and domestic violence and child care, et cetera. Once they know and they have the information, because those impact them so personally, all of those, they will vote right. Mm-hmm. And or they may run or get somebody to run. And I think that women, as has been the case for hundreds of years, are underrepresented politically, certainly on every level, school board on up to legislature. We have about, I guess, a quarter of us who are a little less, who are women in the legislature, but it's not enough. It should be 50% of us. And
so tell me why you think that is. We've been stuck at about the national average, about 25% now for several sessions, and the majority of them are Democrats. For example, in the Senate, there are no Republican women senators. What difference has it made that women are so prominent within the Democratic Party and in the legislature, and in fact have held some of the leadership positions? What difference does it make?
It makes a difference on the kinds of bills that get passed or get killed. I think a great example is the women in the Senate this time. As you just mentioned, there are only Democrat women in the Senate this session.
And the Republicans are in the majority.
In both houses. But they held a caucus on the Senate floor about one of the anti-choice bills. It was either the fetal rights bill or it was one of Dwayne Grimes' mini bills, but they held it in plain sight of those guys and made their plan and what they were going to say with them all watching. I mean, they couldn't hear them, but they just stood in one corner of the Senate, and it was clear what they were doing. They were caucusing around a particular anti-choice bill, and they defeated it. And so it makes a difference. It makes a huge difference. Women voting as a block, just like anyone else voting, any other group or organization or group of people, voting as a block makes a huge difference. And it makes a difference in the kind of legislation that gets introduced. Although I can't say men wouldn't introduce contraceptive coverage, they well may, but we didn't have any chomping at the bit to ask to do it. I mean, we had Christine Kaufman carry that. And it makes a difference in committees. It makes a difference during the argument, during the debate of the merits or the demerits of the bills, because women bring, obviously, a different experience, both shared and individual, than men do. And they reason differently, and they listen better as a group than men, I think. So I think it's huge, and we need younger women. Not just women, but younger women, and younger progressive women. The Republicans' women in the House this time are as conservative as they come. They are far, far, far to the right. And there's more of them than have been maybe ever, but certainly in a long time. So they know they can bolster their side that way, and we need, with term limits now, yes, there are some good things with term limits, although I would never support it. I think term limits are voting people in and out of office, but you can lose good folks. I mean, lots of folks who were termed out, we didn't replace them with women, or women who were termed out didn't get replaced with women. Yeah, you'd get a great guy in there, but it'd be nice to perpetuate. It'd be nice if women, like myself, knowing they're going to get termed out, would be searching for a woman to run in their stead, so that we keep the buildup of women, and we don't. We actually went down this time, and you've probably heard this nationally as well as in Montana, a little, because the term limits in the number of women serving in state legislatures, and I just don't think that's a trend we want to support. We want to support a trend of bringing up more women and younger women, and one way to do that, obviously, is to work with young women or younger women to sit on boards, to run for school board or city council or any elected board in your city or county, so that they get the experience both of running for election and standing up and publicly speaking and being able to take the shots and all the things that make women, again, this generalization, but tend to make women more nervous than men and more uncomfortable.
Well, one thing people often say about politics is it's all about power, and that's a dirty word, and frequently the stereotype is that women aren't as comfortable with issues of power as men are. How have you come to understand issues of power and yourself as a woman holding power in the legislature?
Well, I think women just don't like the rules around it as well. They're less comfortable with the rules in terms of being really aggressive or being able to stand up to somebody who's being really aggressive to you. They are more wanting to accommodate. They're more willing and I think able, usually good negotiators. And so the rules are all by the old boys club, but you're playing within the field. You're on the team with the old boys club. And to me, it seems that it's more about the rules than the actual power itself, and that may be an individual perspective, but I think women don't like those rules. They're less comfortable with those rules. If they could have designed their own rules, and they do when they have their own clubs or their own whatever, they have their own rules, and they operate very differently than when they're operating within the men's rules. But I think women, I mean, in this legislature, our minority leader is a woman, and I think she's pretty comfortable in a position of power. Last time our minority leader was a woman, Kim Gillen this time. Last time we had Emily Stonington.
Time before we had Vicky Cotterell.
Yeah, so it's not like women don't get into positions of leadership. They do, and they should, and they need to continue to strive for that. And certainly we don't have any chairs of any committees because we're in the minority, but we have several women, and myself included, who are vice chairs of committees. And when you're in those positions, you need to, you know, for me, it was like, well, I'll just try this out. I tried some procedural stuff, and I stopped up a couple of bills I wanted to stop up on procedure. And you just got to get in there and get your feet wet. It certainly helps to have a mentor or two. And we did that this time, actually, or leadership did that. They assigned mentors and mentees, and Christine Kaufman and I were paired up, which was great fun. And they did that for everybody, so because half of our caucus is freshmen. So every freshman came in was assigned a mentor, and then you had a mentee. And the deal, what we did with that was just check in with them, especially at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Make sure they're comfortable, make sure they understood how the committee's work, make sure they understood how to introduce a bill, et cetera. There was other trainings, too. Mm-hmm. But when you're working one-on-one with somebody, you can work a little harder. And the other thing we did this time that was interesting, right away at the beginning, Joan Hurdle, within the first week, maybe a week and a half, and I hosted the Democrat Women of the House only at our house. And we talked about the pervasive institutionalized sexism and what that was like and how to deal with that. Well, interestingly enough, a lot of that walked out the door of term limits, a lot. I'd say 95% of it, no kidding, which was great. And these new freshmen are not getting taught these old ways because those guys aren't there. But there was already, within that first week and a half, some women who were having trouble with it. And we really just came up with a plan just to be united and to call these guys on the spot on it. And if you were with somebody who was getting hassled for some reason, because sometimes it's hard when you're the person to make the call, that you would make the call as the person who is standing there observing whatever. And we've had very little trouble with it this time, as compared to last session, which I found to be just unbelievable, horrendous.
Examples of kinds of things that women might feel harassed about as legislators?
Well, again, this time really was much calmer, and it's my understanding it was for everybody, not just me, but from a personal experience, last session for me, really inappropriate sexual comments daily from both sides, just as many Democrats as Republicans. It was not about party. It's not what it was about. But that's very demeaning and very belittling, and in the end, it's very disempowering, and it definitely affected me. It affected my ability, in particular, to stand up on the House floor. I was fine in committee, but in front of 99 folks on the House floor, I was really very intimidated. I definitely got psyched out, and it definitely got worse as the session went on. I didn't start psyched out, but I got psyched out. And so we wanted to avoid that, so since we had so many new women and so many freshmen. We really wanted to step in right at the top and say, you don't have to put up with this. We're not going to put up with this. And we got leadership involved. Kim was involved. And we did one follow-up meeting at our house about halfway, a little past halfway in the session. And people were doing fine. So that was a really a women's caucus of sorts. No question, that's what it was, except that we didn't invite the Republican women or even the senators, because it's just different dealing in the different houses. It was just...
Oh, and over the years, it's taken different forms.
It takes different forms.
All women, sometimes it's been just women in one house or one party, but so there has been a continual thread for probably 20 years of...
Yeah, the last
that
session,
felt neat.
We didn't have any women's caucus, and, you know, it was certainly clear to lots of people that I was having a hard time, and the comment that was made to me is, well, you know, you're just really attractive, and so that's your problem. It's like, you know, well, what is that about? That's not helpful. That certainly didn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was appalling, and it didn't help anything. And so this time we just thought if we got everybody together and talked about it, people would feel stronger. And people did feel stronger, and they felt empowered to tell these guys no, and that was not acceptable. Mm-hmm. And then we heard a couple of great tales of people saying, I just told this guy, you know, if you say something to me again, I'm going to report it to McGee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, wow.
Violation of the law,
yeah.
Yes.
And so that was really good. I think it was a really empowering thing for all of us.
Well, tape is about out.
Lucky you.
Lucky the women 50 years from now who listen to this tape. So thank you, Gail.
Thank you. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah.